Good morning, everyone. I call the Bicameral Fund Working Group to order. The time is 9. We've got two clocks that are competing, kind of like some of the comments in our reports, but we'll just call it 9:03 a.m. on July the 8th, 2019. On Senate records today, we have Eric Heimbigner and Nancy Hemingway. Good morning. And lawmakers in the audience today, I see Ms. Hannon from the House of Representatives, Harriet Drummond, Representative Drummond, Senator Gray Jackson. Am I missed anybody? Senator Wilikowski, sorry, there,
sir. Not very loud.
All right, good. With that in order, we do have Representative Merrick online and Senator Hughes. I know Senator Hughes is at the LIO in Anchorage. Representative Merrick, I don't know where you're located.
I'm at the LIO also.
Very good. Okay, Senate members present in the room today are Senator Stedman, Representative Adam Wool, Representative Christ Tompkins, myself, Senator Bishop, again, Senator Hughes is online, and Co-Chair Johnson, you can go ahead and repeat what I just said again on your house members.
Well, we can, since what we have in the room is Representative Christ Tompkins, and Representative Wool, and online is Representative Merrick.
All right, and cell phones, everybody knows the drill. I'm a little out of practice. First off, I wanna, is the voice good now? Everybody can hear me? I wanna thank my colleagues, my co-chairs and staff from both offices and every one of you at the table. I was away on, out of state on business, and I'll leave it at that. I'm back, and I appreciate everybody pulling into the traces and picking up the slack for me, and thank you for that. So, but that's what we do here in Alaska, right? All right. So with that being said, today's presentations from the three working groups. We're gonna start with a full statutory dividend first, and that would be Senator Hughes and Representative Christ Tompkins. Who would like to go first or tell me how you're gonna wanna work the presentation?
Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop, and I was just talking with Senator Hughes this morning, and I believe I'll be presenting, but since Senator Hughes is online, Shelley, feel free to chime in when I'm done if I missed or misstated anything. Would it be all right to proceed?
Floor is yours.
So I know members have in their possession our work product, and Senator Hughes and I went over a couple of points that we wanted to emphasize, some of which are not in the work product, some of which we think merit emphasis or are sort of the salient takeaways. Overall, I want to thank Senator Hughes for, I think, a very constructive working relationship, a healthy tension, a lot of good back and forth. I think is unsurprising to working group members. Some of the statements in this working group document, one of us may have more equity in than the other, but we ultimately approach this with a consensus and concurrence kind of mindset. There's a huge amount that was cut out because we sort of couldn't get there and in a very respectful way, and we tried to, I think if you eliminated the footnotes, I think this maybe hits the two-page mark. So that was our goal. I also want to note Senator Hughes and her staff, Buddy Witt, did a tremendous amount of work on the footnotes and a lot of the research and backup there, and I'd also like to thank Kevin McGowan in my office for a lot of work he did, including editing and reviewing. Just a couple of other sort of overall notes. There's a few typos in here, most
Johnson,
of which are My fault. Yes, Shelley, go ahead.
Yeah, could I just, I want to break in just a note, as you mentioned staff, I also want to give credit to Sonia Kawasaki, who had a lot of background information and helped us with the citations, and to note that even though you don't have the appendix right now, it is available. It was sent in an attachment to a paper that I did earlier. It's the same appendix. It's a number of documents from legislative finance and others, so that appendix still applies to this paper, and we'll make that available.
Thanks, Shelley. And the appendices that Senator Hughes is referring to are mentioned in page 3 at the top, that they're included, and we'll work with Darwin and Aaron to make sure that those are made available online. And a couple of the typos I'll take responsibility for, I think we submitted at 12:15 a.m. Sunday morning, so it's kind of reminding me of college. I think maybe the hour got the best of us, but those are a couple of the overall comments, and also thank you to the co-chairs for the flexibility on timing and making sure we had adequate runway to get something together that felt like a good, solid work product. In terms of the bullets that Senator Hughes and I discussed earlier this morning as a part of a presentation.
Jonathan, can I interrupt one more time?
Absolutely.
Before you get into the meat and the content, just want to mention, as part of the process, we estimate, not counting our own personal time, working on building this and editing and deciding what we could go with and what we couldn't. We spent probably about 5 hours on the phone in different phone calls working through this, just so people get a sense of the time and focus we put into the paper.
Thanks, Shelley. Yeah, and Google Documents was our best friend for the process. So to the points in the paper, on the social and economic impacts, I think sort of the broad summary statement, and it's really worth noting that we considered a $3,000 statutory dividend in isolation, independent of net social economic impacts from other budget decisions, which we all know are out there. But broadly speaking, we both agree that the permanent fund dividend is a positive and broadly powerful institution. In Alaska, and it's, you know, there's nuances and complexities, and some of these bullets speak to that, but, you know, all equal, Alaskans having $3,000 extra of cash in their pocket, generally a good thing, not a bad thing. We looked at some of the research, much of it from ICER, that quantifies or evaluates the effects of the PFD as an institution in the state of Alaska. On the fund source side, and I think this is where things get more interesting and is probably sort of reflects the trajectory of this working group and the legislature and the state as a whole, Ledge Phi, OMB, Commonwealth North, everybody and their mother, it seems, has kind of evaluated, and there's a basic tension here between size of the permanent fund dividend, size of the operating budget, and amount of revenues the state of Alaska has, and lo and behold, we did not discover that there's a fourth missing variable that has escaped the attention of every Alaskan for the last 5 years. That is noted, but I think one piece, and Shelley and I spoke about this morning, and it's also in our working group paper, that we wanted to note is that of all the available options in looking at fund sources for $3,000 statutory PFD, we agree that overdrawing or overspending the permanent fund itself in excess of the percent of market value is the least desirable or the worst option. And maybe that's a statement that makes Utred here at the head of the room happy. And Shelley and I have different perspectives about what that balance of fund sources should be. Again, unsurprisingly, I'm sure to anybody. That was sort of, I think, one point of concurrence that I hope is important. Shelley, anything you'd like to add or correct that I just said?
I think you did a good job. I do want to note that in the appendix, you'll see on the top of page 3, in addition to what we laid out there as how those numbers fall, we applied the same items to whether we did the short-term financials for a full statutory PFD. What we did was based on the budget that's before us, but we also did one based on what OMB gave us as what would they would consider a right-sized budget for FY20, and basically that right-sized budget it's an estimate, but it is 50% more based on NCSL per capita spending. So take the national average NCSL spending for state and federal funding and then add 50%. And so we did that run, and then we also did that runs with the 50-50 QMB for our current budget as well as what we're calling the Barnhill right size budget from OMB.
Thanks, Shelley. And one other point that Shelley and I discussed this morning, and this is a segue into the closing remarks, but it relates to the fund sources section or sustainability of the PFD, like how do you pay a $3,000 PFD question with which we were tasked, is the necessity of a grand compromise of some sort that reflects the existence and I would even say validity of each of the three major sort of camps or perspectives out there in Alaska, which we enumerate at the end of page 3 and the start of page 4, those three perspectives, and I'm sure we can all identify legislators who identify or sort of belong to each of these three perspectives, one that pay the full statutory PFD and get all the money out of the operating budget, i.e. budget cuts, another being pay the full PFD and raise the revenues to pay for it, and the third being reduce the size of the PFD to reflect a balance with operating budget and revenues. All those camps exist out there. Shelley and I aren't necessarily in the same camp, but a grand compromise will have to reflect all three perspectives, the validity of all three perspectives, and the compromise. There will have to be equity from all three groups of people in order for that compromise to work. Furthermore, we feel that there's a mathematical imperative. There's an unsustainability with existing fund sources, i.e. we don't have the money with existing fund sources, that grand compromise should happen this year because we don't have the money and there aren't the fund sources to continue on an interim sort of basis as we have been in past years. As Senator Hughes pointed, go ahead, Shelley.
Could I please interject at this point? And there's a slight difference in perspective, so I just want to be clear. The unsustainability, I believe that Representative Price Tompkin is referring to unsustainability of paying the PFD the way it is. I would frame it as an unsustainable budget at this point. The ERA is sufficient to continue to pay PFD in my mind, but I just want to make that difference. But we do have to consider it all together, so I do agree with that.
Thanks, Shelley. I think that sort of speaks to the three viewpoints that the paper lines out. And as Shelley pointed out when her and I spoke this morning, there's also a political imperative, maybe that's too strong a phrase, but a process consideration for Alaskans as well as this institution or this branch of government, that something be proposed and ideally passed this year, in that it allows for a full year's worth of review, deliberation, and dialogue with Alaskans before the 2020 election cycle, as opposed to trying to roll something out next year in 2020. And I guess that's kind of getting at, we both agree that whatever is proposed, that there should be an element of unbreakability to settle the question for a generation, to avoid the year-to-year back and forth and tug of war and everything that we all know about, and that a constitutional amendment or amendment should be a tool employed as a part of this compromise to provide that unbreakability and that generational certainty on the permanent fund dividend and permanent fund questions. And ergo, us as the legislature forwarding that this year is important because, as we all know, constitutional amendments are ratified by the voters, and that provides that year's worth of runway for dialogue and deliberation with Alaskans versus, as Shelley pointed out, trying to put something out of the legislature in May 2020 and having kind of a bum rush through the summer to the fall election cycle to have that conversation. Shelley, there's just one more bullet point I'm seeing as a sort of that we is not in the report, but that we talked about this morning and agreed that we wanted to put on the record, and that is it's not, you know, core to any of the questions in our document per se, but we both feel that PFD eligibility is a conversation this working group should consider and perhaps put forward recommendations. It's sort of all interrelates and is interdependent with these broader, bigger questions. So that was a side point of concurrence between the two of us. Shelley, did I let me know if I misstated anything, or was there anything you'd like to add?
No, you did a great job, Christ Pumpkins. I will say that one of the reasons why we think it's important, or at least I think it's important to look at the eligibility requirements, especially if there's any adjustment in the current statute, is, as you know, if you are eligible, let's just say for a moment, the historic formula is adjusted downward. If fewer people are eligible, that helps bump it up a bit and just would make it more palatable for the public. I would also say when Representative Christ Tompkins overviewed the social impact, economic impact, the context of historical dividends, and then in the closing, there are some very key bullets, and he didn't talk about those specifically, and that are real positives. And I do think it's important for members to consider it. Well, these are things we did agree with. These are things that are factual. These are things that are cited. And every legislator, wherever you are on the scale of, you know, 0% to 50%, I think they are valuable to consider going forward. And I would encourage members, I'd encourage the public to read the specific points. We tried to make it readable, and I think even though it looks like it's 4 pages, it's really not because of the citation. So it would only take a few minutes to read. Thank you.
Any follow-up closing comments, Representative Tom?
No, I'd just like to thank Senator Hughes for an excellent process and working relationship.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Feelings
are mutual.
Yes, I would just like to thank you both. I think this is a well thought out paper. You took the assignment. You did the all-nighter, it sounds like. But I think you really did address all the questions that we had, and I was glad to see that you came to agreement on a lot of things, and this will be very handy for the legislature and for the finance committees as we move forward. Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes?
I would just like to add, and because I think we were kind of talking overlapping, I do want to thank Representative Christ Tompkins. It was a good process, and I also want to mention, as I did in the last meeting, that I did submit a longer document that we worked on and trimmed down. So I do want to say that's available, and I did submit it, and I hope it can be published. We have also published it on the through my judiciary chairmanship under the SJR 5 constitutional amendment on the PFD, so that document and the appendices are available, but it adds even more positive points. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. I guess echo the comments of my co-chair. It was well done. I read it this morning, and I appreciate both of you working in tandem to present this document, and well done. So next up, Representative Merrick and Senator Stedman. Representative Merrick, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you.
All right, good. And Senator Stedman? Floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to throw the ball down to my trusty aide at the end of the table, an aide to Representative Merrick, and they'll go through their couple-page white paper, if we could, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Ruaro.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm actually going to defer to staff or Ms. Merrick, Representative Merrick, to lead off, and I'll back clean up if that's okay.
Perfect. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm Sorcha Hazelton, staff to Representative Merrick. Our proposal that we put together was on the surplus dividend. The assumptions we made in addressing the surplus dividend was assuming that the POMV draw first goes to funding state government and legislation, operating budget and capital budget, any other legislation passed, and then whatever's left in the general fund is divided amongst Alaskans. That leaves a PFD amount based on a number of calculations from legislative finance, given different scenarios, anywhere from $865 to a near $3,000 dividend. Our white paper left off that largest number, as that was addressed by other members of the working group. We assumed, as given the concept of a surplus dividend, that there would be no deficit, as addressed in the last meeting by legislative finance, that there's no deficit. Sorry, I'm collecting my thoughts. This makes moving forward, if this were to become the policy of the legislature, a sustainable option, because dividends would always be paid after state government. That's not necessarily the legislators behind this paper view as the best option, but it does make it a budgetarily sustainable one. The economic impacts that we included in our white paper are not necessarily specific to a dividend amount, as neither is our paper. For social impacts, our amount was less, seeing it is less than the other papers presented by the working group. We addressed an ICER report that suggested a lower PFD amount results in lower substance abuse crime. That was the only impact that may be different in our paper to the others in the working group. That's all I have to say. If you want to take over.
Mr. Chairman, just a few additional notes. You know, the surplus dividend scenario suggests a higher priority placed on spending for state government initially, and then if a dividend is paid with the remainder. I just want to note that all state government spending is not 100% optional. There are court cases out that require the state to fund education, the Moore case, the Casile case. So there is a level of funding that has to be made constitutionally. So it's not a pure option between state spending and paying a dividend. There is some level of state funding that we're required to make by law. That's Article 7, I think, in the Constitution and some other provisions. So it is a scenario that places a higher priority on funding state government. Some of that state government spending is required constitutionally. At what level is probably unclear. So I just wanted to add that as a footnote. Otherwise, the as Ms. Hazelton mentioned, the surplus dividend option is a sustainable approach. It just becomes a policy choice of what you're funding first.
Thank you. And for the record, your name is? Again,
I'm sorry. My name is Randy Ruraro, staff for Senator Stedman, R-U-A-R-O.
Thank you. Representative Merrick, any comments?
The comment I would like to make is one that I echoed last meeting, and it's regarding the surplus dividend. If we don't have a conversation about a spending cap with this surplus dividend, it is my prediction that the size of government will grow and there will be nothing left over for a permanent fund dividend. And so I think that's an important thing to note in this scenario.
Thank you. Senator Stedman, wrap up, sir.
Well, we have a spending limit, and it hasn't erased the dividend for the last 30 years. So I don't think the dividend's going to go anywhere. As far as being eliminated, at least anything that I've ever seen and reviewed. So I wouldn't worry about that, Mr. Chairman, about it dissipating. I think the concept of using the surplus revenue in any given year for a dividend is a part of the puzzle we need to look at, or the building blocks, and go north from there while we continue to look to the longevity of the permanent fund to make sure that it's there for future generations long after we're gone. So I don't think there's any course for those watching at home, any course that the legislature is going to be on or ever be on to eliminate the permanent fund dividend.
Thank you for those comments, Chair Johnson.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Bishop. I guess I have one question, but before I say again, this is another excellent paper, and I've just been impressed with all three papers and the amount of research and time that have gone into these papers. The previous paper suggested that the dividend has been one of the elements that's given the fund life, and it's protected the fund as far as the legislature going into it to fund things that would then dissipate the fund, that it's a good check and balance. Do you see with this net dividend, do you have that same kind of check and balance, and does it present legislature the stress level they need as far as budgeting? Does it provide the environment where legislators would be inclined to cut the budget in order to give a higher dividend?
Well, Madam Chairman, having the dividend coming out of the earnings reserve for the permanent fund, which the permanent fund was not initially structured to do, created the intent that it was intended to create, which was to have the public pay attention to the permanent fund and to encourage the legislature not to spend the permanent fund. But let's not forget that the permanent fund was created to help the state with its financial challenges after the oil basin is depleted or frankly gone. So I think that's done that. A little bit of tension, I guess, has some value between the dividend and the operating budget, but I'm personally more inclined to have and more comfortable with a predictable and robotic structure where the dividend is paid out regardless of our current fiscal situation that given year, and that would, I guess, be created when we restructure the written formula. I think we were on the right track for many years, and hopefully when we're done with this process, and restructure the dividend formula, that it'll stand for 30 or 40 years if we do it correctly. This is what I think the current one's well over 30 years old. So that's what I'd like to see. The goal of the committee and the legislature next couple of years is come up with something that lasts for several decades.
Representative Kelly? Merrick, sorry.
In response to your question, you know, I think what you alluded to does give Alaskans an incentive to be involved in the process. However, I have to respectfully disagree with my working group partner that the current spending cap is ineffective, and unless that is changed somehow, you know, government will slowly eat away at those funds, and there will be nothing left over. I believe that is my take on it, and I believe it is the opinion of many of the House minority members.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks to the group. Well done. I would like to put on the record, co-chair of Finance, Senator Von Imhoff, has been with us for quite some time in attendance this morning. Senator Olson, I forgot to mention earlier, is on a plane. He should be landing as we speak, so to his constituents at home, he has contacted me a day ago, and he's en route. And at this time, we're up for option number three, and Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have my paper in front of me, and I can sort of walk around it or talk around it, or I can just read it.
However you want.
I'm just going to read it because the other two presentations, I have them in front of me, but not everyone listening has them in front of them. So I think mine is more of a story, not exactly story, but
you can,
there's a couple typos in here too I want to correct. So
you want to just wing it?
I'm going to wing it.
That's fine.
Well, I mean, we were tasked with a $1,600 PFD, and economic social impacts and how to pay for it, funding sources, and words have already been spoken about economic and social impacts of a permanent fund, lifting people out of poverty and so on. I think in the first presentation there was some disagreement about the sort of ancillary impacts if we do pay a full PFD, what happens to the rest of the budget and how that affects people. I found the discussion on crime interesting in that after the permanent fund is paid out, property crime decreases, although one of the studies said substance abuse increases. So I don't know what to make of that, except that maybe people don't have to steal to get their substances for a period of time. I don't know if that's good or bad, but anyhow, I'll just read mine here. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation has been dispersing dividends since 1982. A lot of this, of course, we've gone over in the last several meetings, but since that time, the permanent fund has become a fixture in Alaska society. This working group convened because points of view differ greatly on what the future of the permanent fund should look like. Regardless of one's stance, most agree the permanent fund has changed the way Alaskans perceive the role of their government over the years since its establishment. Notably, Alaska does not have any kind of broad-based tax, such as income or sales tax, and the permanent fund is the only fund of its kind that delivers dividend payments directly to its citizens. So, in the previous discussion about the permanent fund dividend being created so the citizens could keep an eye on the fund and not let rampant spending happen, seeing as this dividend is sort of unique to our fund, how do other funds stay in existence without a dividend program? And I think they do it pretty well. Norway's often cited as another kind of sovereign wealth fund, and they don't pay a dividend, but that fund is doing quite well. So I'm not sure that the dividend is actually necessary to keep the fund sustainable. I think the 5.25% draw or 5% draw that we've enacted is another way to keep it going. The permanent fund dividend program wasn't created as a needs-based program to inject cash into the hands of low-income families, nor is it created as a percentage of overall income as a parameter. And the reason I say that is because when we talk about reducing the permanent fund, often we're cited by what percentage of income that would be. A low-income person losing $1,000 is more significant overall percentage of their income. However, when the PFD was created, Nobody said it should be an equal percentage of everyone's income. They just gave it out as a dividend. Initially, was based on longevity, although that was ruled unconstitutional. So it was just given out flat. The original first one was $300 or thereabouts. It was also created to keep citizens more involved in the workings of the permanent fund and to incentivize them to prevent the government from reckless spending down of the fund that is meant to provide for generations to come. Economic impacts, 1984 paper published by ICER, who gets often cited for these studies, outlines many positive economic impacts of the PFD and describes general support among Alaskans for the program. The report finds that lower income households are more greatly impacted by the dividend program than higher income households. And my paper says adjusted for inflation, but it is not adjusted for inflation. The average payout has been $1,100 since its inception. Adjusted for inflation, it's about $1,600 or $1,700, as was stated in other papers. The amount of $1,600 was the amount paid out in 2018 and is higher than the average, not adjusted for inflation, over the last 10 years. Although there are certainly positive economic impacts of putting $1.5 billion into the economy, there are also negative outcomes. Anecdotally, you know, in recent times, many more purchases are done online and go to companies headquartered outside of Alaska, so a lot of the money does not stay in Alaska, and airline tickets or vacations or, you know, even going to a box store down the street, most of that money leaves the state, and I don't know that they do a bunch of more hiring right after the PFD to account for business. There is probably a short-term bump in some employment. Social impacts. As a sovereign wealth fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund is something of an anomaly, being the only one to disperse dividends. This has created a unique perspective about the purpose of the fund among Alaskan residents, which has been noted by Angela Cumming of the University of Oxford in a recent a research article published, Basic Income Studies, Why the World's Sovereign Wealth Funds Are Not Paying Basic Income Dividends, and talks about the PFD and its support. But the PFD program runs irrespective of whether the state of Alaska is in surplus or deficit. Also, universal income programs are generally needs-based, but I've since been told some of them are not needs-based. They pay everybody, although there's more of an experimental thing. I don't know that there's a lot of universal income programs where everyone gets a basic income, and maybe Representative Christ Tompkins can help me out on that later. Every year, at least 25% of mineral resource royalties must be put into the corpus or principal of the permanent fund, regardless of whether Alaska can balance its budget. During several years over the past decade, the permanent fund has grown while the state budget of Alaska has faced deficits. Despite a deficit in 2000, the legislature appropriated an extra $250 million for the permanent fund principal from the earnings reserve. From the Norwegian perspective, such an arrangement means the Alaska Permanent Fund is not achieving its purpose of being a savings fund. The savings are built on a fiscal illusion of surplus, where the obligation to pay dividends becomes detrimental to the long-term financial health of the state. The legislature becomes constrained as the dividend program becomes an expected component of an individual's income. An October 2003 poll by Dittman Research found that 64% of Alaskans believe that they were entitled to their dividend, even if Alaska has a budget deficit. Middle ground can be found in this debate. There are options to provide funding for adequate state services such as K-12 education, public safety infrastructure, Alaska Marine Highway, and Pioneer Homes, and still provide funding for a reasonable, sustainable permanent fund dividend to disperse checks to eligible Alaskans. In discussing funding sources, at the time that we wrote this, the budget was such that we had about enough for a $900 PFD, and to get it up to $1,600 PFD, we would have to get $400 million to supplement it. Our list of places to get it from were from the earnings reserve account, which would be overdrawing SB 26, the general fund, which would be reducing the budget more, which the governor's veto have done, the CVR account, which would require a three-quarters vote, school head tax, which would be a revenue source, abolishment of oil tax credits, which would be another tax change to add more revenue, or income tax. And we concluded that given the above sources, it seems the CVR is the only one that can be achieved. Tapping into the earnings reserve goes against SB 26 and will also overdraw the fund and put it at risk. Tapping to the general fund will cut programs beyond reasonable level. Any other type of tax is very difficult politically and likely will be vetoed by the governor. And as I said, the vetoes have come through to the tune of about $400 million, coincidentally. So, but as we said in the paper, it's cut programs beyond a reasonable level. And I think I and others have heard from many people that the cuts instituted have created a bit of a backlash. Opportunity costs or gains with that level of dividend, a $1,600 dividend is a negotiated amount. It doesn't directly correlate to any specific equation. It matches the dividend dispersed in 2018. And here's another typo. It is not obtainable without making cut to state operations because we don't foresee having a surplus of $1 billion for PFD checks given our current revenue budget situation. And then at the end, I interjected something. This is my own thought and doesn't represent Senator Olson, and maybe he'll be here in a few minutes. But and I was just suggesting that if $1,600 is the dollar amount that's sort of pre-negotiated, and to justify it or to sort of reverse engineer a formula, I used some of a bill that I'd worked on earlier this session, and I found a compromise that basically would take a percentage of POMV, which people have talked about, and also a percentage of oil revenue, and combining them each, 20% of POMV, 20% of annual oil revenue will bring in about $1,600. And the reason I suggest that is because if we look into perpetuity, as we've talked about, coming up with something that would last for many, many generations, not just one. We don't want to have this battle while some of us are still legislators. But the concept of oil revenue, I think, has to be connected, or the state's fiscal situation. And right now, our two primary sources of revenue, as of last year, is the POMV draw and oil. And oil can do anything. We all know that. And when the oil basin runs out, which is what the permanent fund was created for at the time, with limited or negligible oil revenue. And the global situation's changing all the time. Who knows what oil's going to do? If maybe in 50 years people won't want to burn oil. So if the permanent fund is independent of oil revenue, but the state of Alaska is not independent of oil revenue, so I think oil should be brought into the equation somehow, so that if oil goes to zero, that should affect how much we pay our citizens, because that will greatly affect how we run our state if oil revenue goes to very low levels. And before we sign on to agree to pay in perpetuity a large percent of our draw of the permanent fund, I think some consideration should be made to other revenues that we take in as a state. That was just my section at the end, not Senator Olson. So.
Thank you. And Senator Olson's not here, but I want to take a brief at ease. Don't nobody go anywhere. Okay, we're back on the record. Thank you, Representative Wohl, and I will all thank Representative Olson, because I have been on the phone with him throughout this process. And thank you for your presentation. I'd just like to say there's some common themes and common threads through all three of these. So I think there's some movement going forward and some commonality. So. With that being said, I would like to thank everybody for their presentations. I know it's been a long year for us, and then to do this assignment
right at the, a couple weeks ago, I believe, we got this assignment. Thank you all for that. I would just like to say the next meeting of the Bicameral Permanent Fund Working Group will be announced after the co-chair and I discuss further meeting schedules. And any closing comments, Representative Johnson?
Yes, thank you. Again, I'm very pleased with all three of these papers. I think they had a lot of time and effort and hard work in them, and I hope that legislators, this is very timely for this week, I hope legislators take the opportunity to read each of these papers, because these are questions we're all being asked, and this is a work in progress. We will be, as I say, it's something we all should be using, because there's a lot of time and effort in the papers, and I hope everybody in this body, in this building, looks at each of them. Thank you.
All right. With that, the meeting is adjourned at 9:50.